I don't ever remember experiencing slippery lichen like that.
Yeah.
Like, so slippery.
Yeah.
Jesus.
It was. Like, even the flat spots, you had to be really careful about where you step.
You had to be really careful.
I'm Matt Podolsky, and in 2022, I attempted a through hike of the Appalachian Trail with my mom, Candy Podolsky.
Oh, it was very stressful. Yeah. I hope we're done with that.
I know. I'm not sure if we are, but...
I'm not sure that we are either. But... might as well keep going.
Yeah.
Even in the best weather, hiking the Appalachian Trail is tough. But throw in... and things can get downright scary.
These peaks are not that tall, but it's just a exposed rocky ridgeline with a lot of really steep but short ups and downs. We've had two thunderstorms blow through. They just dumped water on us. And there's a lot of these rocks are just covered in this green lichen that just felt like you're stepping on like a soapy bathtub floor. I didn't fall completely over, but I came really close a couple times, and but my mom fell a few times, like I think three times. Nothing serious, but she's gonna have some bruises. Now it's getting kind of late, and we're still probably about 5 miles away from the shelter that we were planning on going to.
Just as complete darkness was setting in, we arrived at the shelter. And moments before we slid into our tents, again, it started raining hard. This wasn't the first or the last extreme weather event that my mom and I would experience on the trail. As long as people have been through hiking, they've been getting caught in thunderstorms, floodwaters, heat waves, you name it. But things are shifting. Our changing climate is affecting all aspects of the trail and the trail experience. This is Common Land, and in this episode, we're talking about how climate change affects the Appalachian Trail.
There just may be closures because for safety or resource reasons that it's not safe, it's not sustainable to keep the resource open, fire, flood, whatever it is.
Hawk Matheny is the vice president of trail management at the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. It's his job to make sure that the trail is an actual hikeable path.
You know, up until recently, a through hike of the AT, you know, some years are wetter, some years are drier. There may be some lingering snow in the Smokies in some years, you know, these sort of variables, but there never really has been a major condition that prevented a linear through hike.
A linear through hike. This is what a lot of people, like me, are hoping to experience on the Appalachian Trail. If we think of the AT as a book, I want to read that book front to back, every word. No skipping over the boring parts or jumping to the end before reading the middle. The truth is, there have always been trail closures. Sections get rerouted for maintenance, trails erode, and trees fall down. But today's challenges are bigger. Take the Pacific Crest Trail, another epic hike that runs from the U.S.-Mexico border to the edge of Canada.
It's a continuous trail in the sense of what's on the ground, but experientially, is it a continuous trail?
For the past several years, massive wildfires across the West have prevented thru-hikers on this trail from being able to complete a linear thru-hike. Hikers are instead forced to take large detours around active wildfires and/or recently burned areas. Out of safety, they're having to skip whole chapters of the book.
The fire is now 0% contained, fueled by the extreme drought, and it's burning in an area where there have not been any recent fires. ABC's Alex Brochet leads us off tonight from California.
Tonight, firefighters battling explosive flames along the California-Oregon border. Jackson County Search and Rescue guiding at least 60 to safety from the Pacific Crest Trail.
For a long time, it felt like the Appalachian Trail was immune to these kinds of disruptions. That is, until 2023.
We had two major closures last year because of fire in the south, just north of the Smokies and then Virginia. With the trail closed for weeks on end.
It was a mess. There was flooding in the north, fires on southern parts of the trail. Even when the trail was passable, other hazards cropped up. Smoke from fires in Canada choked the skies and forced people to pause or slow down. Then, in the fall of 2024, Hurricane Helene made landfall in Florida, then stalled in southern Appalachia, causing catastrophic flooding.
Organizers with the Appalachian Trail reports that Hurricane Helene was the worst natural disaster that the trail has seen in its 100-year history.
I think that there are going to be sections of the trail that are going to have to remain closed for the foreseeable future. I would say at least through next year's hiking season.
Flooded rivers washed away bridges and downed trees crisscrossed the AT, making hundreds of miles of the trail impassable. But the communities of southern Appalachia were in crisis. Over 100 people died in North Carolina alone. Many AT hikers set aside their goals of completing the trail to aid first responders throughout the area. Climate change is reshaping the Appalachian Trail. And to ensure that the trail will survive the next 100 years, Hawk Matheny is being forced to consider drastic changes to the AT's path. One of the results of a changing climate is bigger shifts between droughts and floods. Small streams can become raging rivers that wipe away sections of the trail. Fragile alpine zones can become more susceptible to damage. Some of the parts of the AT experience that people love the most might have to change.
Walking along a brook or a river is a scenic experience, right? It can be enjoyable. And you could say the same thing about alpine areas, like the ridgeline walks, right? Is very scenic and very fulfilling.
Trail management, by the way, is full of jargon. Hawk refers to sections of the trail as alignments.
Those alignments are not necessarily sustainable in light of climate change. So we have to be cognizant of that the AT experience in an adaptive mode may be different in some of those locations in order to protect those areas from further impacts.
All this is to say, we didn't realize it at the time, but my mom and I were extremely lucky. We were part of the last class of Appalachian Trail thru-hikers to take it for granted that weather conditions would allow us to complete a linear thru-hike. But just because we weren't forced off trail doesn't mean that we didn't experience extreme weather.
It is gonna be hot. We are officially in a heat wave. We heard someone on the radio say that on our drive out to the trailhead this morning, that it is the third day in a row here in this area where temperatures have been well above 90. It's supposed to continue for at least another 3 or 4 days with, I think, temperatures hitting 97. So the heat wave is here. We're walking through it. Hopefully it won't slow us down too much.
These are some of the biggest changes coming to the Appalachian Trail. Thru-hikers tend to start in the spring and finish in the fall before the weather gets too cold to hike safely. But now, wildfires and extreme heat are making summers more dangerous, and winter, well, is becoming less wintry.
Of all this, it's the saddest part for me is the loss of winter. You know, I live in northern New England. I'm a snow and winter enthusiast, and to see that be compromised, it just saddens me that that won't exist the way it has. That may open the AT up for this flexibility we're talking about. Like, winter may not become like the barrier season.
What all this means is that people may still be able to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail, but instead of going from end to end, they might want to do different sections at different times of year, skipping ahead a few chapters, then going back later to read what you missed. This will be a big change for AT thru-hiking culture, but one that is fast approaching. At one point during my AT hike, it was the middle of summer, but it was so dry that it started to look like fall.
Before this series of rainstorms and thunderstorms yesterday, we'd been in a drought in this area. Everything was really dry. And we could tell this throughout this most recent section in northern Pennsylvania and then into New Jersey and New York. When we were up on these ridgelines, everything was just dried out. A lot of the undergrowth was dead, just dried to a crisp, all the leaves. And then walked through numerous areas today, yesterday as well, where the trail is just covered in newly fallen leaves.
I think for those experiencing drought on the trail, what that means is that the experience from walking between shelters or taking day trips, that you're going to experience less and less availability of water on the trail.
That's Katie Allen, the Director of Landscape Conservation for the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. She told me this isn't just a problem for the trails themselves. It's also something hikers are going to need to be careful about.
Which creates a, you know, potentially a public safety issue for us managing the trail and thinking about that critically of how that might, you know, be mitigated in the future.
One of the things that's strange about hiking the Appalachian Trail nowadays is that as you're seeing evidence of climate change all around you, you're also seeing evidence of the social changes and historic events that are the cause of the problem.
The visionaries of the Appalachian Trail were not thinking about climate change, right? But they were there at the start and in the progress of the Industrial Revolution.
So I'm walking across an old mining road. It's actually a surprisingly narrow path through the forest, but it's raised. And so it feels like I'm walking across the top of an old rock wall. I believe this is a path that was built and used for carrying iron ore.
These are hiking trails meant to promote a, quote, wilderness experience. But to create it, trail builders used old mining infrastructure that is anything but. This region of the Hudson Highlands, which encompasses the mountain ridgelines on either side of the Hudson River in New York, was known for its production of iron in the 1700s and the 1800s. Mining of iron ore in this area began in the 1730s, and by the mid-1800s, it was a booming industry, with the iron produced in this region fueling the Union's war effort during the Civil War.
This is a path not for a motorized vehicle. This is a path for, like, a horse-drawn carriage or something to carry the iron ore. Again, we've got more evidence here of that sort of really early stage of resource extraction, the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, at least here in the U.S.
And it wasn't just in New York where we'd been seeing these artifacts of these early stages of the Industrial Revolution.
We saw the trail went right past that really old blast furnace in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. And then we walked through an old coal mining camp, also in Pennsylvania. Just another example of an interesting type of pathway that was interconnected with all these other footpaths to create a contiguous 2,200 mile long trail.
It isn't a coincidence that the first blast furnaces used to make iron in the United States were located in the Appalachians. After all, this is where the resources were. These early blast furnaces were built where there was a river or stream nearby to power the bellows, and where iron ore could be found in abundance. The first blast furnaces used charcoal as fuel, but by the early 1800s, most had been converted to coal.
Those parallels really create these connections to the current condition that we're in.
We'll be back with more about climate change and the Appalachian Trail after a short break. Hey there, adventurers. Are you ready to hit the trail this season? If so, check out Big Agnes, the mother of comfort. Whether you're backpacking, car camping, or sleeping under the stars in your backyard, Big Agnes gear is built for comfort without compromise. Their award-winning sleeping bags, pads, and tents are lightweight, durable, and feel like home, no matter where you roam. Say goodbye to cold, stiff nights, and hello to plush, cozy sleep in the wild or your backyard. Find Big Agnes at an outdoor retailer near you or at bigagnes.com and feel the difference. Big Agnes, comfort built for the backcountry. We're back. I'm Matt Podolsky, and this is Common Land, a show about the Appalachian Trail. As a person who loves to hike, I've become familiar with the complex relationship between conservation and recreation. Some of the most beautiful and most popular parts of any trail tend to also be some of the most fragile. That's something Katie Allen of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy knows all about.
And I think the visionaries didn't think about how protecting high elevations, what that would mean in the future. They just saw high elevation places to hike and they wanted to go up and see what it was like and enjoy that wilderness experience. But as a result, the benefits that we're experiencing is that those high elevations are protecting headwater streams that are providing fresh water to millions of people. For one example, the headwaters of the entire city of Atlanta is just a feet off of the footpath in Georgia.
So even though the Appalachian Trail was established for strictly recreational purposes, there have been unforeseen benefits for environmental protection.
Now, favorably and coincidentally, we've also got this land base that we can build off of with really no gaps. And that's unique in the East.
Again, that's Hawk Matheny.
The AT provides the ability also to connect habitats across a long geographic area, unmatched to anything else in the eastern United States right now in terms of a continuous corridor that provides quality habitat.
These steep slopes and tall mountains and deep ravines and diverse soil types, they create these microclimate pockets that offer plants and animals the opportunity to move around in local neighborhoods. So I think it's really, really important to consider the connection of all of those.
Despite the remarkable resilience of Appalachian ecosystems, many challenges lay ahead as our climate continues to change. That's because even though the Appalachian Trail protects these areas from development, Appalachia is poised to grow. And Katie thinks that shouldn't be seen as a bad thing.
There are going to be specific challenges that the Appalachian region is going to be faced with that might be quite a bit different than what other folks might be experiencing in other places. We're going to see increased migration from folks from the coastal areas of the East Coast, the southern regions of the U.S. as temperatures increase and water and climate impacts the coastal areas. And Appalachia is really, really well suited for bringing those folks into the region because it's still generally rural. And it has a lot of really great amenities, but that's going to be our biggest challenge in the future. As the small rural communities receive more and more climate refugees, we're going to see increased demand on infrastructure, roads, and our electric grids. We're going to see increased pollution that will have rippling impacts to natural resources, but also create public health issues. So we're in an incredible point right now of what do we need to do to organize ourselves, to create the partnerships, the coalitions, the diversity of professional expertise related to not just conservation and climate change, but economic development, workforce growth, and affordable housing.
It's clear from speaking with both Hawk and Katie that the Appalachian Trail Conservancy sees this moment as a turning point for the trail. The Appalachian Trail Conservancy was established in 1925 as the Appalachian Trail Conference, and as the organization celebrates 100 years, a bold new vision for the future has been laid out. This vision positions the Appalachian Trail as a tool to increase the region's resilience to climate change, providing not just recreational opportunities and protected habitats, but also economic development.
One role that ATC does play is advocating to see more funding be realized for diversity of needs in Appalachia. So we push funders to think about critically how conservation funding needs to increase and also how it can be leveraged to support economic development, public health, and a multitude of other needs, all the way up to infrastructure development like wildlife crossings and the ability for multiple benefit shifts and changes in decision-making and policy that can increase ecological connectivity that hasn't been part of the conversation yet to date. And that would be the future of seeing climate resiliency and mitigation and adaptation be truly realized on the landscape, as when we can align policy and funding mechanisms to see these benefits at the community level.
It's kind of like a lot of things with climate change. We know what to do. It's the will and the resources to do it. The scale of like World War II, the build out of the U.S. interstate system, you know, the moonshot in the 60s, like when you put all your resources towards this shared national agenda, great things can be accomplished. And that, and you can include the AT in that. Like if we had the resources and the political will to operate that scale to offset the effects of climate change, you use those three examples to show what's possible.
It's July 23rd. Still in the midst of this heat wave. Supposed to get up into the mid-90s today, although it's a pretty comfortable right now in the high 60s, low 70s, but it's 6 o'clock in the morning, so we've been getting up pretty early to do as much of our hiking as possible in the mornings, early mornings when it's nice and cool. We've been doing pretty consistently 20 mile days for a while, but once we got into New York and it got hot, the terrain got a little more challenging, we slowed down, and it's been a bit of a slog through New York State, specifically in large part just because of this heat, but also because of some unexpectedly challenging terrain.
Yeah, look at this. Welcome to Connecticut. Gateway to New England. All right. Should we get a picture?
Here. My mom and I crossed the border into Connecticut at the end of a long day of hiking, and we were exhausted. Our hike through New York had left an indelible mark on us. A few weeks back, my mom had tweaked her Achilles tendon while climbing up a steep slope. It seemed like a minor injury, so she kept walking. But by the time we reached Connecticut, it was screaming at her.
I am hiking on my own today because when we got up this morning, we just had like a mile and a half to hike to get to this little country store where we were going to do a quick resupply. But by the time we got to the store, my mom, her Achilles tendon was bothering her like a lot, and it had been sore for like a few weeks, and she finally decided that she needed to take a break and get it checked out, and it worked out quite well that we had that stop planned. And she just texted me telling me that the doctor told her that she has a partially torn Achilles tendon.
Hi.
Hey.
Well, that sucks, huh?
Yeah, Jesus.
I did not expect that. I thought they were going to say ice, elevate, and be back in 5 minutes.
I know, me too. I don't even know how that's possible, given that you've been walking on it for so long.
The guy couldn't believe that I've been walking on it.
Jeez.
He said, you're incredibly lucky you didn't tear the whole thing, because once you tear a partial tear, you're at high risk for tearing the whole thing.
Right.
And he's, yeah. And I was like, well, I was being careful. And he's like, okay, we're getting you off that leg and you're not putting any weight on it. And I'm like, oh, come
on. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you going to do?
So what's the timeline? What did they say?
The partial tear is more intense at the beginning of a recovery, but it's quicker. Gotcha. So the answer is he doesn't know. He wants me to see an ortho guy and see what they have to say. But yeah, I was not happy. He sat down and he said, this is serious. And I'm like, oh, come on. Hey, I made it more than halfway.
I know. He's made it really far.
I know. Son of a bitch. All right. Well, have fun hiking today.
Yeah, thanks.
And I'll see you in a couple of days, probably.
Yeah, I'll keep you updated.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
All
bye.
Right. Bye.
My mom's injury took me by surprise and left me in a position of uncertainty. Would she be able to recover and continue her through hike, or was she done for the season? Should I keep hiking or wait for her to get back on trail?
There's definitely a part of me that wants to just be like, well, if you're not hiking, then I'm not going to hike and I'll just hike whenever you're ready. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As I struggled with this decision, I encountered another unexpected obstacle to my through hike.
Oh gosh, it's just... It sucks that I feel like right now. Yeah, this is definitely the lowest point on the hike.
And in our next episode, I learn about another one of the effects that climate change is having on Appalachia, increasing the spread of Lyme disease.
You've been seeing a real measurable rise in Lyme rates in southern parts of Canada, where previously weather conditions were just not great for ticks.
Common Land is a production of the Wildlands Collective. This season was produced in partnership with New Hampshire Public Radio. This episode was produced by me, your host, Matt Podolsky. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. To listen to the next episode in the series, just search for Common Land in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the show and to see a full list of credits, go to commonlandpodcast.com.